The third setting will take you directly to the rift machine.
Malamba took it. Femita, I mean to try to close the rift. Femita shook his head.
Malamba, even with your powers, I don't think you can. Scores of magicians worked to create the Great Rift, and the controlling spells were established only on the Keliwan side. The Midkemian machine is only to stabilize the rift's location.
I know, Femita. You'll soon know, for I've sent my works to Hocho. My mysterious research has been an intensive study of rift energies. I may now know more about them than any other magician in the assembly. I know it would be a desperate, possibly destructive action from the Midkemian side, but this war must end.
Then get free to your homeworld and wait. The Emperor will act soon, I am sure. The Warlord could not have been handed a bigger blow by losing the war than the one you handed him in the arena. If the Light of Heaven orders peace, then perhaps we can deal with the question of the rift.
Stay your hand until you've learned what the King's reaction to the peace offer is. Then you also play the great game? Femita smiled.
I am not the only magician to descend into playing politics, Malamba. Hocho Pepper and I have been part of this from the onset. Go now, and may the gods be with you. I wish you a safe journey and a long, prosperous life on your homeworld.
He then walked past Malamba and his family. Once he was out of sight, Malamba activated the device. The soldier jumped. One moment he had been sitting under a tree, shaded from the setting sun's heat. Then the next moment a magician with a woman and child suddenly appeared before him. By the time he was on his feet, they were moving toward the rift machine, several hundred yards away. When they reached the machine, a platform with tall poles rising up on either side of it, between which a glimmering nothingness could be seen, an officer who was in charge of the troops moving through snapped to attention.
Get these men back from the platform.
Your will, Great One.
He barked orders, and the men fell back. Malamba took Katala by the hand and led her through the rift. One step, a moment of disorientation, and they were standing in the middle of the Surani camp in the valley in the grey towers. It was night, and campfires burned brightly. Several officers were startled at the unusual arrival, but stepped out of their way. Malamba said,
Have you captured horses?
One of the officers nodded dumbly.
Bring two, at once, saddled.
Your will, Great One,
said the man, and rushed off. Soon a soldier brought two horses toward him. When the soldier came close, Malamba could see it was Hokonu. The younger Shinzawe son looked quickly about as he handed the reins to Malamba.
Great One, we have just received word something terrible has occurred at the Imperial Games, though the reports are vague. I suspect your sudden appearance here has something to do with those reports. You must be away quickly, for these are the Warlord's men in camp, and should they arrive at the same conclusion, there is no telling what they might risk.
Malamba held William, while Katala mounted with Hokonu's aid. He handed their son up to her and mounted his own steed.
Hokonu, I have just seen your father. Go to him. He has need of you.
I will return to my father's estate, Great One.
The young Surani hesitated, then added,
Should you see my brother, tell him I live, for he does not know.
Malamba said he would, then turned to Katala and took the reins of her horse.
Hold to the saddle horn, beloved. I will carry William.
Without another word, they rode out of camp. Several times guards started to challenge them, but the sight of the black robe stopped them. They rode for hours in the moonlight. Malamba could hear the shouts of soldiers as he led his family to safety. Katala bore up under it all like the warriors she was descended from, and Malamba marvelled at her. She had never sat a horse before, but she made no complaint. To be taken from her home and whisked away to a strange dark world where she knew no one must be a frightening experience. She revealed a tough fibre to her character he had only guessed at before. After the seemingly endless ride, a voice sounded from out of the darkness. Dim, shadowy figures could be seen moving among the trees.
"Halt! Who rides this knight?"
The voice was speaking the king's tongue. The three riders halted, and the man in front, with relief in his voice, shouted,
"Pug of Cridey!"
Chapter 12. Upheaval. Colgan sat quietly. It was a reunion tempered with sadness. Pug stood near Lord Borick's bed, openly showing his grief as the dying duke smiled wanly up at him. Liam, Brucall, and Meacham waited a short way off, speaking softly, and Katala distracted William while the duke and Pug spoke. Borick's voice came softly, weak from his illness, and his face contorted with pain as he struggled for breath.
"I am glad to see you. Return to us, Pug. And doubly glad to see your wife and child."
He coughed, and foam appeared at the corner of his mouth, flecked with blood. Katala's eyes were tearing, for the open affection her husband held for this man touched her. Borick motioned toward Colgan, and the stout magician came to stand next to his former pupil.
"Yes, Your Grace."
Borick whispered, and Colgan turned to Meacham.
Will you see Katala and the boy to our tent? Lorry and Kasumi are waiting there."
Katala threw Pug a questioning look, and he nodded. Meacham had already picked up the boy, who regarded him with some skepticism. When they had left, Borick struggled to sit higher, and Colgan helped him, placing pillows behind his back. The duke coughed loudly and long, his eyes clenched tightly shut from pain. When at last he could breathe again, he sighed, then spoke slowly.
"Pug, do you remember when I rewarded you for saving Carleen from the trolls?"
Pug nodded, afraid to speak for the emotions he felt. Borick continued.
"Do you remember my promise of another gift?"
Again Pug nodded.
"Would that Tully were here to give it to you now. But I will tell you in brief. I have long thought the kingdom wastes one of its greatest resources by regarding magicians as outcasts and beggars. Colgan's faithful service over the years has shown me I was right. Now you return, and though I understand only a little of what you've told, I can see you have become a master of your arts. It was my hope you would, for I have had a vision. I had left a sum of gold in trust for you, against the day you became a master magician. With it, I would like you and Colgan and other magicians to establish a center for learning, where all may come and share. Tully will give you the documents with my instructions, explaining in detail my design. But for now, I can only ask, will you accept this charge? Will you build an academy for the study of magic and other knowledge?"
Pug nodded, tears in his eyes. Colgan stood agape, not trusting what he had heard. His fondest wish, his life's ambition, shared with the duke in the idle hours of speaking of dreams over cups of wine, was now granted. Borick began to cough again, then, when the fit passed, said,
"I hold title to an island in the heart of the great Star Lake, near Shamata.
When this war is at last done, go there and build your academy. Perhaps someday it will be the greatest center for learning in the kingdom.
Again the Duke was racked by coughing, the sound more terrible than before. He gasped after the attack, barely able to talk. He motioned for Liam to come close, pointed to Pug, and said, "Tell him!" Then fell back upon his pillows. Liam swallowed hard, fighting back the tears, and spoke to Pug. "When you were taken by the Serrani, Father wished for some memorial in remembrance. He considered what would be proper, for you had shown bravery on 3 occasions, twice saving Colgan's life in addition to my sister's. He judged the only thing you lacked was a name, for none knew your parentage. So he ordered a document drawn up and sent to the Royal Archives, inscribing your name on the rolls of the family Condoyne, adopting you into our house." Liam forced a smile. "I only wish times were gladder to share such news with you." Overcome with emotion, Pug sank to his knees at the Duke's side. He took the Duke's hand and kissed his signet, unable to speak. Softly, Boric said,
"I could be no more proud of you than you were my own son."
He gasped for breath.
"Bear our name with honor."
Pug squeezed the once powerful hand, now weak and limp. Boric's eyes began to close, and he struggled for breath. Pug released his hand, and the Duke motioned for all to come closer. Even old Brucal was red-eyed as they waited for the Duke's life to slip away. To Brucal he whispered,
"You are witness, old companion."
The Duke of Yaban raised an eyebrow and looked questioningly toward Colgan.
"What does he mean?"
Colgan said,
"He wishes you to witness his dying declaration. It is his right."
Boric looked at Colgan and said,
"Care for all my sons, old friend. Let the truth be known."
Liam said to Colgan,
"Why does he say, all my sons? What truth?"
Colgan stared at Boric, who nodded weakly. The magician's words came quietly.
"Your father acknowledges his eldest son, Martin."
Liam's eyes grew wide.
"Martin?"
Boric's arm shot out in a sudden surge of strength, catching at Liam's sleeve. He pulled Liam to him and whispered,
"Martin is your brother. I have wronged him, Liam. He is a good man, and well do I love him."
To Brucal, he croaked a single word,
"Witness."
Brucal nodded. With tears streaming down into his white moustache, he swore,
"So do I, Brucal, Duke of Yaban, bear witness."
Suddenly, Boric's eyes went blank. His death rattle sounded deep in his chest, and he lay still. Liam fell to his knees and wept, and the others also let their grief come unrestrained. Never to Pug had a moment been so bittersweet. That night, it was a quiet group in the tent that Meacham had commandeered for Pug and his family. The news of Boric's death had cast a pall over the camp, and much of Colgan's joy at seeing his apprentice return safely had been blunted. The day slowly passed, with everyone becoming reacquainted, though they spoke softly and felt little joy. Occasionally one would leave the tent, wandering off to be alone with his thoughts for a while. 9 years of history had been exchanged slowly, and now Pug spoke of his flight from the Empire. Katala kept one eye on William, who lay curled up on a bed with one arm thrown over Fanta's. The Fire Drake and the boy had taken one look at each other and decided they were friends. Meacham sat by the cook fire, watching the others carefully. Laurie and Kasumi sat on the floor, Serrani fashion, while Pug finished his narrative. Kasumi was the first to speak.
Great one, how is it that you could leave the Empire now and not before?
Colgan raised one eyebrow. He was still absorbing the changes in his former apprentice. This talk of greater path and lesser path was still difficult to understand. And he couldn't believe the Surani attitude toward the boy. He amended that. The young man.
After my confrontation with the warlord, it became clear to me that I would serve the Empire by leaving. For my continued presence could only bring divisiveness at a time the Empire needs to heal itself. The war must be ended, and peace established, for the Empire is being drained.
Aye, added Meacham, as is the kingdom. 9 years of war are bleeding us dry.
Kasumi was equally discomfited by the casual tone these people took toward Pug.
Great one. What if the Emperor cannot stop the new warlord? The council will surely be quick to elect one.
I don't know, Kasumi. I will then have to try to close the rift. Colgan pulled long on his pipe, then blew a thick cloud.
I am still not clear on everything you have said, Pug. From what you have said, I can see nothing that will prevent them from opening another rift.
There is nothing, except that rifts are unstable things. There is no way to control where a rift will go. It was mere chance that caused the one between this world and Kelliwan. Once that one was established, others could follow, as if the path between the two worlds acted to other rifts like a lodestone to metal. The Surani could attempt to re-establish the rift, but each attempt would probably take them to other new worlds. If they returned here, it would be by the merest chance, one in thousands. If the rift is closed, it would be years before they returned, if ever.
From what you said about the warlords taking his own life, said Colgan, can we expect a respite in the fighting?
It was Kasumi who answered.
I fear not, friend Colgan, for I know this warlord's sub-commander. He is Minwanabi, a proud family from a powerful clan, and it would serve his cause well when the High Council meets for his clan to bring word of a great victory. Most likely he will attack in force within days.
Colgan shook his head.
Meacham, you had best ask Lord Liam to join us. He must hear this.
The tall Franklin rose and left the tent. Kasumi frowned.
I have come to know this world a little, and I agree with the Great One. Peace would surely profit us both, but I do not see it coming.
The young Duke followed Meacham into the tent a few minutes later, and Kasumi repeated his warning.
We had best be ready then for the attack, said Liam.
Kasumi looked uncomfortable.
Lord, I must beg your pardon, but should fighting come, I cannot stand against my own people. May I have your permission to return to my own lines?
The Duke considered this, and Pug noticed that his face was becoming lined with the strain of command. Gone were the laughing eyes and ever-present smile. Now he resembled his father more than ever.
I understand. I will order you pass through the lines, if I have your parole that you will repeat nothing you have heard here.
Kasumi agreed and rose to leave. Pug stood also and said,
I will issue one last order to you, Kasumi, as a magician of Suranawani. Return to your father, for he has need of you. One more soldier dying will aid your nation little.
Kasumi bowed his head.
Your will, Great One.
Kasumi embraced Lori and left with Liam. Colgan said,
You have told me so much that is difficult to absorb. I think for now we had best retire, for I feel the need of resting.
As the old magician rose, Pug said to him, There is one thing I have been waiting to ask.
What of Thomas?
Your childhood friend is well, and with the elves of Elvander. He is a warrior of great renown, as he had wished to be.
Pug smiled. I am glad to hear that. Thank you.
Colgan, Lorry, and Meacham bade them good night and left. Katala said,
Husband, you are tired. Come, rest.
Pug crossed over to the bed she sat upon.
You amaze me. You have been through so much tonight, and yet you fret about me.
She took his hand.
When I am with you, everything is as it should be. But you look as if the weight of the world sits upon you.
The weight of two worlds, I fear, love.
They were awakened by the sound of trumpets. As they rose from the bed, Pug and Katala were startled by Lorry rushing into the tent. From the light behind him as he tossed aside the tent flap, it was evident that they had slept late.
The king comes!
He held out some clothing to Pug.
Put these on!
Seeing the wisdom of not walking the camp in the black robe, Pug complied. Katala pulled her robe on over her head, while Lorry turned his back. She went over to William, who was sitting up in his bed, looking frightened. He quickly calmed down and started to pull on Fantas's tail, causing the drake to snort a protest over such indignities. Pug and Lorry left the tent and walked to the commander's pavilion, overlooking the camp of the kingdom armies. Away to the southeastern end of the camp, they could see the royal party quickly approaching, and could hear the cheers of the soldiers as they saw the royal banner pass. Thousands of soldiers took up the cheer, for they had never seen the king before, and his presence served to lift their spirits, badly sagging since the rout by the Surani. Lorry and Pug stood off to one side of the command tent, but close enough to ensure they could hear what transpired. Duke Brucor kept his eyes on the king, but Liam noticed the two and nodded his approval of their presence. The two lines of royal household guard rode up to the front of the tent, then parted so the king might ride to the fore. Roderick, king of the realm, rode on a huge black warhorse, who pawed at the ground as he came to a halt before the two dukes. Roderick was dressed in a gaudy array of gold-trimmed battle armor, with many flutings and reliefs fashioned into the breastplate. His helm was golden, with a circlet crown. A royal purple plume flew from the crest, blown by the morning wind. When he had been sitting for a moment, he removed his helm and handed it to a page. He stayed atop his horse and studied the two commanders, looking down at them with a crooked smile.
What? Have you no greeting for your liege, lord?
The dukes bowed.
Brucall said,
Your Majesty, we were just surprised. We had no word.
Roderick laughed, and the sound was tinged with madness.
That is because I sent no word. I wanted to surprise you.
He looked at Liam.
Who is this in the tabard of Crydee?
Liam, your majesty, answered Brucall. The Duke of Crydee.
The king shouted. He is Duke only if I say he is Duke.
With a sudden change of mood, he said, in solicitous tones,
I am sorry to hear of your father's death.
He then giggled.
But he was a traitor, you know. I was going to hang him.
Liam tensed at Roderick's words, and Brucall gripped his arm. The king saw and screamed,
You would attack your king? Traitor! You are one with your father and the others. Guards, seize him!
He pointed at the young man. Royal guards dismounted, and the soldiers of the West who stood nearby moved to stop them.
Stop!
Commanded Brucall, and the Western soldiers stopped. He turned to Liam.
On your word, we have civil war,
he hissed. Liam said,
I submit, your majesty.
The Western soldiers grumbled. The king said coldly, I shall have to hang you, you know. Take him to his tent and keep him there. The guards complied. The king turned his attention to Brokaw. Are you loyal to me, my lord Brokaw, or shall there be a new duke in Yabon as well as Crydee?
I am ever loyal to the crown, your majesty, came the answer.
The king dismounted.
Yes, I believe that.
He giggled again.
You knew my father thought highly of you, didn't you?
He took the duke's arm, and they entered the command tent. Lorry touched Pug's shoulder and said,
We had best stay in our tents. If one of those courtiers recognizes me, I may join the duke on the gibbet.
Pug nodded. Get Colgan and Meacham, and have them meet us in my tent. Lorry hurried off, and Pug returned to his tent. Katala was feeding William from a bowl of stew from the night before.
I fear we have found another pot of trouble, love, Pug said. The king is in camp, and he is madder than I dreamed possible. We must leave soon, for he has ordered Liam imprisoned.
Katala looked shocked.
Where will we go?
I can manage to take us to Crydee, to Prince Arutha. I know the court of Castle Crydee as well as if there were a pattern there. I should have no trouble transporting us. Lorry, Meacham, and Colgan joined them a few minutes later, and Pug outlined his plan for escape. Colgan shook his head.
You take the boy and Katala, Pug, but I must stay.
Meacham added, And I. Pug looked incredulous.
Why?
I served Liam's father, and now I serve him. If the king tries to execute Liam, there will be fighting. The armies of the West will not stand idly by and watch Liam hanged. The king has only the royal guard, and they will be easily defeated. Once that happens, it is civil war. Bas Tyra will lead the armies of the East. Liam will need my aid.
Meacham said,
The issue won't be quickly decided. The armies of the West are veteran, but they're tired. There's little spirit left in them. The armies of the East are fresh, and Black Guy is the best general in the kingdom. Liam's unproved. It'll be a long struggle.
Pug understood what they were saying.
It may not reach that point, though.
Brokaw seems ready to follow Liam's lead. But if he changes his mind? Who knows if Yalith, Tearsog, and the others will follow Liam without Yabon's lead?
Colgan sighed. Brokaw will not waver. He hates Bas Tyra as much as Boric did, though for less personal reasons. He sees Guy's hand in every move to break the West. I think the Duke of Yabon would happily take Roderick's head, but even so, Liam may submit rather than risk a civil war and lose the West to the Serrani. We shall have to see what passes. Which is all the more reason you must go to Crydee, Pug. If Liam dies, then Arutha is heir to the crown. Once begun, the king cannot stop the killing until Arutha is dead. Even Martin, whose claim would be blemished by his illegitimacy, and Carleen would be hunted down and killed. Perhaps Anita as well. Roderick would not risk a Western heir to the throne. Upon Liam's death, the bloodletting will not end until either Roderick or Arutha sits the throne of the kingdom uncontested. You are the most powerful magician in the kingdom.
Pug started to protest.
I know enough of the arts to know your skills from the events you related to us. And I remember your promise as a boy. You are capable of feats unmatched by any in our world. Arutha will have grave need of your aid, for he would not let his brother's death go unpunished. Crydee, Kaas, and Tulan will march once the Serrani have been dealt with. Others
especially Brukhor, would join them. Then we would have civil war.
Meacham spat out of the tent. He froze, holding aside the tent flap for a moment, then said,
I think the argument is over. Look.
They joined him at the opening. None had the Franklin's sharp eyesight, and at first they couldn't see what he was pointing out. Then slowly they recognized the cloud of dust hanging in the air, far to the southeast. It spread across the horizon for miles, a dirty brown ribbon that ran below the blue of the sky. The Franklin turned to look at the others.
The armies of the East.
They stood near the command pavilion, among a group of Lamutian soldiers. With Lorry, Colgan, Pug, and Meacham was Earl Vandross of Lamut, the former cavalry officer who had commanded the raid through the valley years ago, when they had first seen the rift. He had gained the title upon his father's death, less than a year after Pug's capture, and had proven to be one of the kingdom's most able field commanders. A company of nobles was riding up the hill toward the pavilion. The king and Brukhor stood waiting for them. Next to each lord rode a standard-bearer, who held the banner of that noble. Vandross announced the name of each army represented. Rudez, Timmons, Sadara, Ran, Seabone. They're all here. He turned to Colgan. I doubt there are 1,000 soldiers left between here and Rillanon. Lorry said,
There is one whose banner I don't see. Bastyra.
Vandross looked.
Salador, Deep Taunton, point his head.
No, you are right. The golden eagle on black is not among the standards.
Meacham said, Black Guy is no fool. He is already upon the throne of Krondor. Should Liam be hanged and Roderick fall in battle, it would be only a short step to the throne in Rillanon.
Vandross looked back at the gathering nobles.
Nearly the entire Congress of Lords is present. Should they return to Krondor without the king, then Guy would be king in short order. Many of these are his men.
Pug said, Who is that under the banner of Salador? It is not Lord Kerris. Vandross spat upon the ground.
It is Richard, formerly Baron of Dolth, now Duke of Salador. The king hung Kerris, and his family fled to Kesh. Now Richard rules the third most powerful duchy in the East. He is one of Guy's favorites.
When the nobles were assembled before the king, Richard of Salador, a red-faced bear of a man, said,
My liege, we are assembled. Where are we to camp?
Camp? We make no camp, my lord duke. We ride.
He turned to Lord Brukhor.
Marshal the armies of the West, Brukhor.
The duke gave the signal, and heralds ran through the camp, shouting the order to muster. The battle drums and war trumpets were shortly sounding throughout the western camp. Vandross left to join his soldiers, and soon there were few observers nearby. Colgan, Pug, and the others moved off to one side, keeping clear of the king's gaze. The king said to the assembled nobles,
We have had 9 years of the western commander's tender ways. I shall lead the attack that will drive the foe from out of our lands.
He turned to Brukhor.
In deference to your advancing years, my lord duke, I am giving command of the infantry to Duke Richard. You will stay here.
The old Duke of Yvonne, who was in the process of donning his armor, looked stung. He said nothing save,
Your Majesty.
His tone cold and strained. He stiffly turned and entered the command tent. The king's horse was brought, and Roderick mounted. A page handed up his crowned helm, and the king placed it upon his head.
The infantry shall follow as quickly as possible. Now we ride!
The king spurred his horse down the hill, followed by the royal guard and the assembled nobles. When he was out of sight, Colgan turned to the others and said,
"Now we wait."
The day grew long. Every hour that passed was like a slowly unfolding day. They sat in Pug's tent, wondering what was occurring to the west. The army had marched forward under the king's banner, with drums and trumpets sounding. Over 10,000 horsemen and 20,000 foot soldiers had advanced upon the Serrani. There were only a few soldiers left in camp, the wounded and an orderly company. The quiet outside was unnerving after the almost constant camp noise of the previous day. William had grown restless, and Katala had taken him outside to play. Phantas welcomed the opportunity to rest untroubled by his tireless playmate. Colgan sat quietly, puffing on his pipe. He and Pug passed the time by occasionally speaking of matters magical, but mostly were silent. Laurie was the first to break the tension. He stood and said,
"I can't take this waiting any more. I think we should go to Lord Liam and help decide what is to be done once the king returns."
Colgan waved him back into his seat.
"Liam will do nothing, for he is his father's son and would not start a civil war, not here."
Pug sat absently toying with a dagger.
"With the armies of the East in camp, Liam knows that an outbreak of fighting would hand the West to the Serrani and crown to Bastyra. He'll walk to the gibbet and put the rope around his own neck rather than see that."
"It's the worst kind of foolishness," countered Laurie.
"No," answered Colgan, "not foolishness, minstrel, but a matter of honour. Liam, like his father before him, believes that the nobility have a responsibility to give their lives work, and their lives, if need be, for the kingdom. With Boric and Erlin dead, Liam is next in line for the throne. But the succession is unclear, for Roderick has not named an heir. Liam could not bear to wear the crown if he would be thought a usurper. Arutha is another matter, for he would simply do what was expedient, take the throne, though he would not wish to, and worry about what was said of him when it was said."
Pug nodded. "I think that Colgan has the right of things. I do not know the brothers as well as he, but I think it might have been a better thing had the order of their birthing been reversed. Liam would make a good king, but Arutha would make a great one. Men would follow Liam to their deaths, but the younger brother would use his shrewdness to keep them alive."
"A fair assessment," conceded Colgan. "If there is anyone who could find a way out of this mess, it is Arutha. He has his father's courage, but he also has a mind as quick as Bastyra's. He could weather the intrigues of court, though he hates them."
Colgan smiled.
"When they were boys, we called Arutha the little storm cloud, for when he got angry, he would turn to black looks and rumbles, while Liam would be quick to anger, quick to fight, and quick to forget."
Colgan's reminiscences were interrupted by the sound of shouting from outside. They jumped up and rushed out of the tent. A blood-covered rider in the tabard of Lamut sped past them, and they ran to follow. They reached the command tent as Lord Bracall came out. The old Duke of Yaban said,
"What news?"
"The Earl Vandross sends word! Victory!"
Other riders could be heard approaching the camp.
"We rode through them like the wind. The line on their east is breached, and the salient is rent. We broke them, isolating those in the salient, then wheeled to the west and rolled back those who sought to aid them. The infantry now holds fast, and the cavalry drives the Serrani back into the north pass. They flee in confusion. The day is ours."
A wineskin was handed to the rider, who sounded as if his voice would fail. He tilted it over his face and let the wine pour into his mouth. It ran down his chin, joining the deeper red splattered over his tabard. He threw aside the wineskin.
There is more! Richard of Salador has fallen, as has the Earl of Sildon, and the king has been wounded.
Concern showed on Bracall's face.
How does he fare?
Badly, I fear,
said the rider, holding his nervous horse as it pranced around.
It is a grievous wound. His helm was cleaved by a broadsword after his horse was killed beneath him. 100 died to protect him, for his royal tabard was a beacon to the Serrani. He comes now.
The rider pointed back the way he had come. Pug and the others turned to see a troop of riders approaching. In the van rode a royal guardsman with the king held before him. The monarch's face was covered in blood, and he held to the saddle horn with his right hand, his other arm dangling limply at his side. They stopped before the tent, and soldiers helped the king from the horse. They started to carry him inside, but he said, in a weak and slurred voice,
No, do not take me from the sun. Bring a chair so I may sit.
Nobles were riding up even as a chair was placed for the king. He was lowered into it and leaned back, his head lolling to the left. His face was covered with blood, and white bone could be seen showing through his scalp wound. Colgan moved to Roderick's side.
My king, may I attend?
The king struggled to see who was speaking. His eyes seemed to lose focus for a moment, then became clear.
Who is speaking? The magician? Yes, Boric's magician. Please, I am in pain.
Colgan closed his eyes, willing his powers to ease the king's suffering. He placed his hand upon Roderick's shoulder, and those nearby could see the ruler of the kingdom visibly relax.
Thank you, magician. I feel more at ease.
Roderick struggled to turn his head slightly.
My lord Bracall, please bring Liam to me.
Liam was in his tent, under guard, and a soldier was sent to bring him out. Moments later, the young man knelt before his cousin.
My liege, your wound?
Colgan was joined by a priest of Dala, who agreed with his assessment of the wound. He looked at Bracall and shook his head slowly. Herbs and bandages were brought, and the king was cared for. Colgan left the priest to his ministrations and returned to stand where the others looked on. Katala had joined them, holding William in her arms. Colgan said,
I fear it is a mortal wound. The skull is broken, and fluid seeped through the crack.
In silence they watched. The priest stood to one side and began praying for Roderick. All the nobles, save those commanding the infantry, were now arrayed before the king. More horsemen could be heard riding into camp. They joined the others who stood watching and were told what had happened. A hush fell over the assembly as the king spoke.
Liam,
he said in a faint voice.
I have been ill, haven't I?
Liam said nothing, his face betraying conflicting emotions. He had little love for his cousin, but he was still the king. Roderick ventured a weak smile. One side of his face moved only slightly, as if he could not control the muscles well. Roderick reached out with his good right hand, and Liam took it.
I do not know what I have been thinking of late. So much of what has happened seems like a dream, dark and frightening. I have been trapped within that dream, but now I am free of it.
Sweat appeared upon his brow, and his face was nearly white.
A demon has been driven from me, Liam, and I can see much of what I have done was wrong. Even evil.
Liam knelt before his king.
No, my king, not evil.
The king coughed violently, then gasped as the attack subsided.
Liam, my time grows short.
His voice rose a little, and he said,
Recall, bear witness.
The old Duke looked on, his face an implacable mask. He stepped over next to Liam and said,
I am here, Your Majesty.
The King gripped Liam's hand, pulling himself a little more upright. His voice rose as he said,
We, Roderick, fourth of that name, hereditary ruler of the Kingdom of the Isles, do hereby proclaim that Liam Condoyn, our blood cousin, is of the royal blood. As oldest Condoyn male, he is named heir to the throne of our kingdom.
Liam shot Recall an alarmed look, but the old Duke gave him a curt shake of his head, commanding silence. Liam bowed his head, and his sorrow was heartfelt. He tightly gripped the King's hand. Recall said,
So do I. Recall, Duke of Yaban, bear witness.
Roderick's voice sounded faint.
Liam, one boon do I ask. Your cousin Guy has done what he has done at my command. I grieve for the madness that drove me to have Erlen deposed. I knew his going to the dungeon was his death warrant, and I did nothing to halt it. Have mercy on Guy. He is an ambitious man, but not an evil one.
The King then spoke of his plans for the kingdom, asking that they be continued, though with more regard for the populace. He spoke of many other things, of his boyhood, and his sorrow that he had never married. After a time, his speech became too slurred to understand, and his head fell forward upon his chest. Recall ordered guards to attend the King. They gently raised him and carried him inside. Recall and Liam entered the tent, while the other nobles waited outside. More new arrivals were gathering, and they were told the news. Nearly a third of the armies of the kingdom stood before the commander's pavilion, a sea of upturned faces extending down the hill. Each stood without speaking, waiting out the death watch. Recall closed the tent flap behind and shut out the red glow of the sunset. The priest of Dala examined the king, then looked at the two dukes.
He will not regain consciousness, my lords. It is only a matter of time.
Recall took Liam by the arm and led him to one side. In a hushed whisper he said,
You must say nothing when I proclaim you heir, Liam.
Liam pulled his arm from Recall's grasp, fixing his gaze upon the old warrior.
You bore witness, Recall,
he whispered back.
You heard my father acknowledge Martin as my brother, legitimizing him. He is the oldest Condoyn male. Roderick's proclamation of succession is invalid. It presumed I was the oldest.
Recall spoke quietly, but his words were ungentle.
You have a war to end, Liam. Then, if you should accomplish that small feat, you have to take your father and Roderick back to Rilanon to bury them in the tomb of your ancestors. From the day Roderick is interred, there will be 12 days of mourning. Then, on noon of the 13th, all the claimants for the crown will present themselves before the priests of Ishap and the entire bloody damn Congress of Lords. Between now and then, you'll have plenty of time to decide what to do. But for now, you needs must be heir. There is no other way. Have you forgotten Bas Tyra? Should you dither, he'll be in Rilanon with his army a month before you. Then you'll have bitter civil war, boy. As soon as you agree to keep your mouth shut, I'm ordering my own trusted troops to Krondor, under royal seal, to arrest Black Guy. They'll toss Bas Tyra into the dungeon before his own men can stop them. There'll be enough loyal Krondorians around to ensure that.
You can have him held until you reach Krondor, then cart him off to Rillanon for the coronation. Either your own or Martin's. But you must act, or by the gods we'll have Guy's lackeys brewing civil war within a day of your naming Martin the true heir. Do you understand?
Liam nodded silently. With a sigh he said,
But will Guy's men let him be taken? Even the captain of his own guard will not stand against a royal warrant, especially countersigned by the representatives of the Congress of Lords. I shall guarantee signatures on the warrant, he said, clenching his gloved fist before his face.
Liam was quiet for some time, then said,
You are right. I have no wish to visit trouble upon the kingdom. I will do as you say.
The two men returned to the king's side and waited. Nearly another 2 hours passed before the priest listened at the king's chest and said,
The king is dead.
Brucall and Liam joined the priest in a silent prayer for Roderick. Then the Duke of Yabon took a ring from Roderick's hand and turned to Liam.
Come, it is time.
He held aside the tent flap, and Liam looked out. The sun had set, and the night sky glittered with stars. Fires had been lit and torches brought, so that now the multitude appeared to be an ocean of firelight. Not one man in 20 had left, though they were all tired and hungry after the victory. Brucall and Liam appeared before the tent, and the old duke said,
The king is dead.
His face was stony, but his eyes were red-rimmed. Liam looked pale but stood erect, his head high. Brucall held something above his head. A glint of deep red fire reflected off the small object as it caught the torchlight. The nobles who stood close nodded in understanding, for it was the royal signet, worn by all the Condoin kings since DeLong the Great had crossed the water from Rillanon to plant the banner of the Kingdom of the Isles upon the mainland shore. Brucall took Liam's hand and placed the ring upon his finger. Liam studied the old and worn ring, with its device cut into the ruby, still undimmed by age. As he raised his eyes to behold the crowd, a noble stepped forward. It was the Duke of Rodez, and he knelt before Liam.
Your Highness, he said.
One by one the others before the tent, nobles of both east and west, knelt in homage, and like a wave rippling, all those assembled knelt, until Liam alone was standing. Liam looked at those before him, overcome with emotion and unable to speak. He placed his hand upon Brucall's shoulder and motioned for them all to stand. Suddenly the multitude was upon its feet, and the cheer went up.
Hail Liam! Long live the heir!
The soldiers of the kingdom roared their approval, doubly so, for many knew that hours ago the threat of civil war had hung over their heads. Men of both east and west embraced and celebrated, for a terrible future had been avoided. Liam raised his hands, and soon all were silent. His voice rang out over their heads, and all could hear him say, Let no man rejoice this night. Let the drums be muffled, and the trumpets blown low, for tonight we mourn a king. Brucall pointed at the map.
The salient is surrounded, and each attempt to break through to the main body has been turned back. We have isolated nearly 4,000 of their soldiers there.
It was late night. Roderick had been buried with what honour could be afforded in the camp. There had been none of the trappings common to a royal funeral, but the business of war made it necessary. He had been quickly embalmed and buried in his armour next to Borwick, on a hillside overlooking the camp. When the war was over, they would be returned to the tombs of their ancestors in Rillanon. Now the young heir looked over the map, gauging the situation in light of the latest communique from the front. The Serrani held in the north pass, at the entrance to the valley. The infantry had dug in before them, bottling up those in the valley, and isolating both the forces along the River Cridy and what was left of the salient.
"We have broken their offensive," said Liam, "but it is a two-edged sword. We cannot attempt to fight on two fronts. We must also be ready should the Serrani try to move against us from the south. I see no quick ending yet, in spite of our gains."
Recall said,
"But surely those in the salient will surrender soon. They are cut off, with little food or water, and cannot expect to be resupplied. In a matter of days they will be starving."
Pug interrupted. "Forgive me, Lord Brokaw, but they will not.
What can they gain by resisting? Their position is hopeless."
"They tie up your forces that would otherwise be attacking the main camp. Soon the situation in Suranuani will be resolved enough for magicians to return from the assembly. Then food and water can be transported in without interference. And each day they hold strengthens the Serrani as reinforcements arrive from Keliwan. They are Serrani and will gladly die rather than be taken captive."
Liam asked, "Are they so honor-bound to die then?"
"Yes. On Keliwan they know only that captives become slaves. The idea of a prisoner exchange is unknown to them."
"Then we must bring all our weight to bear upon the salient at once," said Brokaw. "We must crush them and free our soldiers to deal with other threats."
"It will prove costly," Liam observed. "This time there will be no element of surprise, and they are dug in like moles. We could lose two men for each of theirs." Colgan had been sitting off to one side with Lorry and Meacham.
"It is a tragedy that we have gained only a broadening of the fighting, and so soon after the Emperor's offer of peace."
Pug said,
"Perhaps it is still not too late."
Liam looked at Pug.
"What do you mean? Kasumi must have already sent word that the peace was refused."
"Yes, but there may still be time to send word that there will be a new king who is willing to talk peace."
"Who will carry the message?" asked Colgan. "Your life might be forfeit if you return to the Empire."
"We may be able to solve two problems at once. Your Highness, may I have your leave to promise the Serrani in the salient safe passage to their lines?"
Liam considered this.
"I will, if I have their parole not to return for a year's time."
"I will go to them then," said Pug. "Perhaps we can still end this war in spite of the calamities that have befallen us."
The Serrani guards, nervous and alert, tensed at the sound of an approaching rider.
"They come!"
one shouted, and men seized weapons and hurried to the barricades. The southern earthworks were still intact, but here at the western edge of the former salient, the pickets had thrown up a hasty barrier of felled trees and shallow trenches. Bowmen stood ready, arrows notched, but the expected charge did not come. A single figure on horseback came into view. His hands were raised overhead, palms together in the sign for parley, and more, he wore the black robe. The rider walked his horse to the edge of the barricade and asked, in perfect Serrani,
"Who commands here?"
A startled officer said,
"Commander Watun."
The rider snapped.
"You forget your manners, strike leader."
He took note of the colors and devices on the man's breastplate and helm.
"Are the Chilapanning O so lacking in civility?"
The officer came to attention.
Your pardon, great one,"
the man stammered.
"It is only that you were unexpected." "Bring Commander Watun here." "Your will, great one."
The commander of the Serrani salient came a short time later. He was a bandy-legged, barrel-chested old fighter, and, great one or not, his first concern was for the welfare of his troops. He looked at the magician suspiciously.
I am here, great one.
I have come to order you and your soldiers back to the valley. Commander Watun smiled ruefully and shook his head.
I regret, great one, that I may not. Word of your exploits has been carried to us here, and that the assembly has called your status into question. You may be no longer outside the law by now. If you had not come under a sign of parley, I would have you taken, though it would cost us dearly.
Pug felt a hot flush come to his cheeks. He had known it was likely the assembly would cast him out, but to hear this still caused him pain. Ruefully, he knew that because of the training he had undergone, he would still feel a sense of loyalty to that alien place and would never fully feel at home in his native land. With a sigh, Pug said,
What then will you do?